From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. After the New Zealand attacks on Friday, which left 50 dead, President Trump downplayed the rise of white nationalism around the world, calling it a small group of people. He also came to the defense of a Fox News host who made anti-Muslim comments. We'll talk with a national security expert who believes these sentiments are undercutting the administration's counterterrorism policies. Then at 9:30, by the end of the century, the Bay Area is set to bear the brunt of California's rising seas, if mitigation efforts aren't underway quickly. We'll talk about a new study that finds that up to 400,000 Bay Area residents will be at risk of flooding by 2100. And that's coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. After the New Zealand mosque attacks on Friday, which left 50 dead, President Trump downplayed the rise of white nationalism around the world, calling it a small group of people. But the data says otherwise. In fact, according to the Anti-Defamation League, white supremacist propaganda efforts have nearly tripled since Trump has been in office, and the Southern Poverty Law Center reported more hate groups in the United States last year than at any point in the last two decades, with the Justice Department reporting a 17% increase in hate crimes in 2017. Are Trump's denials of these trends undercutting U.S. counterterrorism efforts? Well, to help us understand all of this and sort it out, we welcome Faiza Patel. She is co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. And welcome to the program, Faiza Patel.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And let's begin by talking about the president's role in this, because there was a lot of tweeting over the weekend by the president, tweeting about John McCain, about Saturday Night Live, about Judge Jeanine on Fox News, but nothing about New Zealand, although he did, and the White House did put out statements about this being an act of hate and being absolutely disgraceful act. But the question is, how much is the president's denial of white supremacy in this and saying that it's really just a small band of people, apparently, undercutting counterterrorism?
Well, I don't think it's just the president. I think one of the things that we've seen over the last decade and a half is that our law enforcement and intelligence agencies have been focused on one threat, which is obviously the serious threat coming from groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But as a result, they've developed a blind spot when it comes to far right-wing terrorism, which includes, you know, a range of groups from neo-Nazis to white supremacists to anti-government groups here at home. And that threat has been treated as sort of isolated incidents as opposed to being treated as something systematic that requires a systematic response.
Well, the administration says it's open to addressing far-right violence. In fact, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, we're open to suggestions. We're all ears on this. Your group has come out with some specific suggestions. Can you give us a brief outline of what you've put forward?
Sure. So one of the things that we think is critical is for the federal government to start counting incidents of far-right violence. So right now what happens is that the Department of Justice publishes lists of international terrorism. That's the category that it puts violence by, individuals who they assume are inspired by Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So that's, you know, both people who are actually operationally linked, but also people who, you know, go on the internet and read something and think, oh, this is a good ideology and it might lead them to violence. So those statistics are out there. But when it comes to right-wing violence, that is just not counted by the federal government. So the very first thing that they need to do is to get a handle on the scope of this problem. Now, there are a number of research outfits that do this kind of data crunching, and what their data shows is that violence from far-right groups has results in almost the same number of fatalities as you see from Al-Qaeda ISIS violence. So we have a sense that this number is actually quite large, but we don't have a definitive data set that we can look at and say, okay, this is the scope of the problem.
I want to get back, if I may, though, to President Trump's role in all this, because the manifesto of the shooter in New Zealand actually said that he was Well, gave him props, I guess, for being part of a white identity movement and common purpose. And here's what the president said responding to criticism. He's been let me actually read this. It's on Twitter. Responded to the New Zealand criticism earlier today. He said, "The fake news media is working overtime to blame me for the horrible attack in New Zealand. They will have to work very hard to prove that one so ridiculous." But there's certainly been a good deal of criticism that the president needs to be seen for his words as well as his actions tied to New Zealand. What do you say?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that at this point, you know, concerns about far-right violence have reached a tipping point. You know, we have seen so many of these incidents again and again where minority communities, whether they're Jews, whether they're Sikhs, whether they're Muslims, are being targeted, often in places of worship, and killed in large numbers because by individuals who are espousing white supremacist ideologies. So this is obviously a big problem, and it's really important for all levels of the administration to recognize this, and obviously that starts with the president. I guess I'm just being realistic. And
Maybe the bigger problem is the internet itself, which has been weaponized by these groups, and which has certainly added a great deal to their ability to actually organize and get the word out to all kinds of people who, well, for whatever reason, may identify with them. But Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney actually defended President Trump's rhetoric just yesterday. Here's Fox News' Chris Wallace asking him about it.
"To the degree that there is an issue with white supremacist, white nationalist, anti-Muslim bigotry in this country, and there is an issue with that, why not deliver a speech condemning it?"
Right. You've seen the president stand up for religious liberties, individual liberties. The president is not a white supremacist. I'm not sure how many times we have to say that.
Well, the president may not be a white supremacist, as Mick Mulvaney says things, but he said he's a nationalist. And just how much, again, does this really feed the problem? Faiza Patel?
Well, I think that everybody recognizes that what leaders say has a huge impact on individuals, right? And so by refusing to condemn these kinds of attacks really strongly, and refusing to recognize that we do have a broader problem with people committing violence based on these kinds of ideologies, I think the president does give succor to the people who are going forward and doing this. I mean, I think it's always difficult to say, oh, well, you know, he's responsible for New Zealand. I mean, not in a direct sense, but he has certainly enabled and encouraged people who believe that minority communities and minorities are invaders who should be cleansed from Western countries. So I think that's true both in word and in deed, right? Remember, this is a president who, you know, put in place a Muslim ban, who has, you know, called for a border wall, going to extreme lengths in order to declare a national emergency that nobody believes really exists to fund his fantasy over there. He's the one who's constantly calling immigrants invaders, who's calling Mexicans rapists. So these things are a combination, I think, of both the policy and the rhetoric that goes along with it.
We're talking with Faiza Patel. She co-directs the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. Trump administration has downplayed the rise of white nationalism following the New Zealand attacks. What are your thoughts? And really, if you'd like to join this conversation and weigh in, we welcome your involvement in the program. The toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now and let us know what your thoughts are. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting comments there at kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I wonder also, Faiza Patel, if you could talk a little bit about, before we go to our callers and get them engaged in this and our read our emails that are coming in and postings on the internet and so forth, the Countering Violent Extremism program, which has been in place really even before the Obama administration, has, I think, from your concern, at least what I've read and what you've expressed as concern, is targeting Muslim and minority communities and inherently making them perhaps more susceptible to terrorism. How's that?
Well, I'm not saying that I don't think I would say that it's making them more susceptible to terrorism. I think the problem with Countering Violent Extremism programs is twofold. The first is there's literally no evidence that these programs work. They are based on this idea that you can sort of identify terrorist tendencies amongst populations who you don't suspect of any crime, or, you know, you've got no reason to be suspicious of them. And that's just not true. There are no markers, there are no indicators that we can look at and predict who's going to become violent and who isn't. And I wish there were, but there aren't. And then the second issue with these kinds of programs is that they have almost exclusively been targeted at Muslims to begin with, but in the most recent round of programs authorized by the Trump administration, they have extended to other minority groups and have identified, for example, refugees, Black Lives Matter activists, LGBTQ Americans as being potential violent extremists who should be watched by the government and who should be regarded with suspicion.
I am going to bring our listeners into this, but let me touch on a couple of quick things before I do that. I mentioned Judge Jeanine Pirro, and the president has come out defending her. She's been rebuked by Fox for making statements about Congresswoman Omar in Minnesota and saying she wears a hijab, and therefore, not only that, but her statement, her anti-Semitic, as they've been characterized, statements show that she supports Sharia and therefore is against our Constitution. This is another form of Islamophobia that needs to be scrutinized, as you see it?
Jeanine Pirro's comment?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But, I mean, that's, you know, that's just the latest in a series of, you know, very anti-Islam comments that she's made. And she's certainly not the only one on Fox News who does that. So it is a sort of systematic demonization of Muslims. It's a systematic sort of hyping of this imagined threat of Sharia taking over the United States. All of this stuff has been, you know, common on Fox News for years now.
And what do you think, since you're at NYU, of Chelsea Clinton being verbally taken a task by Muslim students, particularly one Muslim student, blaming her for New Zealand because she came out saying we shouldn't be trafficking in anti-Semitism?
Well, I think that, you know, again, I think blaming individuals in that way is not really helpful. I think it is important for us to be looking at sort of the narrative and the structures that are in place that promote anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant sentiment, and also all of us scrutinize the ways that you know, what we say plays into that.
Faiza Patel, again, is with us. She's with us from New York, and she's co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. And here's our first caller. Jake, join us. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Your guest mentioned at the top of the hour that there's been kind of a blind spot against far-right and white identity extremism amongst our law enforcement agencies. I just wonder if they had any comment on the fact that our own federal agencies, such as the FBI, have commented extensively on the fact that white identity extremists have worked hard to infiltrate these law enforcement agencies and systemically have, you know, worked to create policies that go after, you know, Black Lives Matter and LGBT activists, as you're discussing, rather than focusing on the more violent and real threat of white extremism.
Your thoughts, Faiza Patel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely an issue in law enforcement and actually in the military as well, right, with having people in positions of authority who are closely tied to white supremacist views. And I think, you know, as they say, the proof is in the pudding. Who does the FBI go after, right? I mean, we do see that they are not going after white supremacists and white nationalists in any systemic way, and they really need to start doing that.
Do you think this ties in with the president's remarks, which have been strongly criticized earlier in the week, about how the military and law enforcement are behind him, a motorcycle gang is behind him, this sort of thing?
I don't know.
No, you have to ask if there's some connection there. I mean, if he's been influenced by the things he's been reading on the Internet from white supremacist groups or that sort of thing, then why even make that statement? Is that I mean, it's almost like a kind of guided threat of some sort.
Yes, I mean, definitely he was trying to be threatening in that particular situation. Look, I also want to be clear. I mean, I certainly don't think that, you know, the FBI is run by white supremacists or that the military is sort of, there's many, many people who are there.
But he didn't mention the FBI. He's been at odds with the FBI. He talked specifically about the military, motorcycle gangs, and law enforcement.
Right. And I think that what I'm saying is that I think that there are sort of small numbers of people in our law enforcement and in our military, and that needs to be weeded out and it needs to be called out. I do think that, you know, the FBI has had a blind spot for white supremacist, white nationalist terrorism. I mean, just look at the numbers, right? So the numbers are that they have over 2,000 agents assigned to counterterrorism, and less than 300 of those are assigned to what they call domestic terrorism, which is where, you know, this white supremacist, white nationalist violence would fall. So you actually have a pretty clear sense of their priorities. And I think that you have to also recognize that this is a long-standing problem. Yes, Trump, you know, crystallizes it because he refuses to condemn white supremacists and because he minimizes the extent of this violence. But this has been a long-standing problem in our law enforcement agencies.
Well, the Brennan Center, where you are involved in national security, has identified acts of terrorism, about 57 of them, saying 51 can be applied to domestic terrorism and they have to be called out. I mean, that seems to be a very strong message that comes from the Brennan Center.
Yeah, I mean, we identified 51 different statutes, domestic terrorism statutes, that could be used to prosecute people. In addition, there are 5 federal hate crimes laws that can be used to prosecute people. And there's also, you know, just a variety of conspiracy statutes, even RICO, which have been used to prosecute domestic terrorists and can continue to be used to do so. I mean, look, it's just a question of priorities, right? And the priorities are set from the top.
And we go to more calls. We go to Jeff next. Jeff, join us. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I'm calling I'm curious why we keep calling it a right-wing crime. I mean, are we then, like, grouping all the right-wing folks into people who hate people? I mean, isn't it just a hate crime? I mean, I'm a Democrat, but I'm just, I worry about using the right wing so hard. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, it's a reasonable question, Faisal Patel. Are we perhaps homogenizing the right wing here, putting too much under that aegis and that brand?
Yeah, I think that's a really fair question, honestly. And when I talk about this, I also sort of struggle a little bit to figure out what exactly the right terminology is to use, because there are a number of groups that I would characterize as being far right, which have engaged in violence. And some of them are, you know, white supremacists, white nationalists, neo-Nazi. But then there are others in that group, like sovereign citizen groups and you know, basically like anti-government groups. So there are like a range of groups that fall in there, and they are, I think you're right that it is a little bit unfair to sort of lump them all together, and I think we just haven't come up with sort of the right terminology to be that people all agree on for describing this movement.
Although there are certainly a lot of people who point to not only the perpetrator in New Zealand, but Caesar Saylor, who sent out all kinds of bombs to people critical of President Trump, or the Rise Above movement, these kinds of things, which have right-wing ideology attached to them. I've got a comment from a listener named Paul who says, instead of blaming the president, trippingly, ask about issues a bit closer to New Zealand. For example, what role does Rupert Murdoch's newspaper play in spreading nationalism down under? I think a fair question. Thank you for that, Paul. And Wayne writes, every government leader must denounce in the strongest, clearest terms anyone who murders unarmed, defenseless groups of people. Any less response is to condone and criminally abet such acts. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Noel. Noel, join us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment is just that I think that it's really important for people in the center and left of the political spectrum to not be fooled by the kind of veiled irony that a lot of these groups use to disguise their true intent when they speak in public. Things like the OK symbol being turned into a white nationalist symbol, things like simple pieces of paper with "it's okay to be white" posted on university campuses are all dog whistles that allow these people to build their organizations. And this is a problem that is not just resurgent in America recently. This is one that has existed in our history from its founding. And this movement is now international thanks to the internet. We've got groups of people, white nationalists online, who are intentionally orchestrating Twitter campaigns out of fake accounts to create confusion and sow discord among people who try to address and call out white nationalist rhetoric when it makes it to the national stage. So thank you for doing this program. It's really important to talk about it. And I just encourage anyone listening to this program, you know, don't doubt people. Your first instinct should be to look closer when you hear someone call out something as white nationalist or racist, because there may be a coded message that you don't understand.
Thank you for those comments. Appreciate them. We'll go right to another caller, and that's Al, who's joining us. Al, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to make a comment in regards to the president's statement during the press briefing about the Muslims, where he stated there was an invasion of immigrants, which ironically is also the same terminology that was used in that the shooter put in his manifesto or letter. And later when he was pressed regarding if he had read the...
Al, it's not a great connection we have with your phone, I'm sorry to say, but he's making a point here I think that's important to highlight, Faiza Patel, and that is language that the president uses, which may be ill-advised. When he used the word invasion, for example, and he used it on a number of occasions, it was also echoed in what happened in Pittsburgh, and it was echoed again by this manifesto in New Zealand.
I mean, there's no question but that words matter, right? And particularly the words for somebody who, you know, is the leader of the United States and has a very enormous public platform. But at the same time, I mean, I don't know if anybody is at all surprised by any of these comments from the president, because he's been saying this since before he was elected. There's literally no change in his rhetoric. There's no modulation. There's no sense of responsibility in terms of how he uses his words and who he targets. So, yes, I completely agree. This kind of rhetoric is completely unacceptable from anybody, but particularly from somebody who is our leader. At the same time, I mean, I guess I've just sort of lost the ability to be outraged by it because it's been happening for 3-4 years now.
Well, there's also the striking statistic that I mentioned in, earlier on in the introduction before we started talking with you, and that is the spike in hate crimes, 17% since 2017. And here's a listener, Curtis, who says, worst case, the president is a white supremacist. Best case, he's fanning the flame. Where is the condemnation by the GOP as a group? Another listener, Callie, writes, my partner and I were stalked and threatened by a skinhead yelling anti-LGBT and anti-Semitic language at us. I ended up filing a police report, contacting the Southern Poverty Law Center, but I found I really didn't know what to do. What does your guest suggest victims do to handle incidents of far-right violence given the FBI's policies?
Well, I mean, I think it's really important to report. You know, we have a massive problem with underreporting of hate crimes. You mentioned that, you know, the FBI had reported a 17% increase in hate crimes, but you have to remember that the FBI actually relies on self-reporting by police departments. So it is a statistic that's a massive underreport by any measure. So it's really, really important that police, that people who are victims of hate crimes actually report them to the police. And I think, you know, sort of the ultimate solution really is for the federal government to take a much bigger role in terms of pressuring police departments to collect the data and, in some instances, to collect the data itself, because that's the only way that we are going to get a handle on how often this is happening and also to make prosecuting hate crimes a priority.
The data, and especially accurate data, is of premier importance, and I'm really glad that you emphasized that as we come to the conclusion of this segment. Faiza Patel, very good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Faiza Patel is co-director of Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's Law School. When we return, we're going to talk about sea level rise. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.